Johnny, don't you slip up or play the fool.
Oh, no more, oh, no da, I'll be your golden boy. I will obey every golden rule. Be good, be good, be good, be good, be good.
Do you want to make waves? Come join us at WHFR 89.3. WHFR is an award-winning, independent, non-commercial broadcast internet and radio station powered by over 50 student and volunteer staff members. WHFR provides Classical 24 programming nightly and Mountain Stage weekly, while also airing weekly local public affairs and specialty talk programming. Come join us, making waves today.
Coming up is the WHFR Journal right here on the station making waves, WHFR Dearborn, from the campus of Henry Ford College.
Good afternoon and welcome to this April 26th edition of the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here. Thank you for being with us at WHFR Radio, Henry Ford College's own broadcast and internet station. It is a pleasure to have you in our listening presence. We say a special thank you to those people that were kind enough to contribute and give us your vote of confidence at Radiothon 2024, which took place last week. We had a blast on this show. If you happen to catch the show, we just enjoyed our time with our former general manager, Richard Pyatt, with Bob Burnham, and several other members of the WHFR staff, kind of getting together and chatting about what this station means to us and what you, frankly, mean to us as well. So we are continuing to do what we do best, and that is provide programming that you're just not going to hear elsewhere on the radio dial, and we're happy to do so. We say a special additional thank you to all of the volunteers and all of the community members that came in to do special pledge pitching for us throughout the week last week. I know we had people take some time and come in and say hi and talk about why the station is important to them and so on. So to all of those listener volunteers who were able to come in, we're grateful for that as well. So we are looking forward to a great show today. We're going to do something that we sort of have turned into a tradition here at WHFR, and it involves a beautiful collection of artistic and creative works. It's called the Barrett Creative Writing Competition. And here at Henry Ford College, students provide their best of the best work for a competition. It's called the Barrett Awards. And we basically have our English department vote on what they think is just exceptional. And the winners receive a special award, special recognition, and an opportunity to share their work at a special ceremony. Well, that ceremony took place last week, and we have it for you just about in its entirety. So it's going to take up almost the whole hour, but some really cool information and great presentations, again, by the students that created the content. We're so proud of the students here at Henry Ford College, and what better way to showcase their creativity and their sort of growing into this next phase of whatever life brings them. We always say, we really only have our students here for a short time. So that part of the journey that we're able to impact them on, we certainly want to do the best we can. So we're excited about it. We're going to share that with you. So again, the Barrett Awards from last week, they took place early last week, and they are coming your way in just a few minutes. In addition, we have an announcement, speaking of our local, you know, wonderful talent, the Henry Ford College Music Department is hosting a special event. It is a free local live music event right here on our campus. So check this out. They're hosting the Metropolitan Symphony Band Spring Concert. It's called New Beginnings and Final Frontiers. It takes place this Monday, April 29th, 7 until 9 p.m. in the Adrey Auditorium. The auditorium is here at 5101 Evergreen Road, right here in Dearborn, and we're very proud of it, and we're excited to see the Metropolitan Symphony Band, one of the bands under the direction of HFC Music Director Anthony Lai. Anthony is newly appointed in that position. This is his first year, frankly, having the position of HFC Director of Music, and he just found out, and we just found out, it is an official permanent opportunity for him to leave his mark and his legacy on this wonderful college. So the Metropolitan Symphony Band. Lai says that the band has been very hard at work, bringing a variety of styles to this year's concert. He also says that they're going to continue their emphasis on new music. So the music to be performed, very eclectic. There will be music from Star Trek, Celtic songs, Scottish music, a Ukrainian dance, and something that apparently Lai describes as a dissonant contemporary piece. Sounds great. Well, he encourages everyone to come to the college and see this performance, and we think you'll be in for a great treat as well. For more information, you can check out the Henry Ford College website, which is hfcc.edu, or you can reach out to Anthony Lai directly at ajlai, L-A-I, at hfcc.edu. Again, it's ajlai at hfcc.edu. Again, a free concert performance in the Adrey Auditorium here on our campus this Monday, April 29th, 7 to 9 p.m. Hope to see you there. Now, we're going to get into the Barrett Creative Writing Awards ceremony. We hope you'll enjoy this. We thank you for being here today and tuning in as a regular listener, a loyal listener here at WHFR. So we'll let this roll and just wish you the best of the weekend and enjoy the show.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. Good afternoon. Thank you all so much for being here at the Barrett Coulter Creative Competition, Creative Writing Competition Awards. The ceremony, this is the 49th year, which is how cool. Like, next year is going to be half a century, which is crazy to me. My name is Summer Starrud. I've been at HFC for only 3 years, but I'm lucky enough to be the new chair of the Barrett competition. And I want to thank our former chair, John Reitz, for seeing me as, yes, a round of applause. It's crazy how you really can't see anything with the lights. I don't know if I like it or not. yes, thank you, John. For seeing me as capable to carry on this really beautiful tradition at the college. It's one of my favorite events since joining the faculty because it's a moment students truly get to feel in real time the fruits of their labor. Traditionally, we lead the ceremony off with a poem. So I thought I would start with the first poem I ever wrote as a child. Just kidding. That would be the worst. I could hear the whole room like, oh no. Today we are celebrating our students and enjoying this afternoon. That said, I wanted to read a poem that acknowledges the places and people not able to feel as safe as we are today. This poem is by Dunya McHale and it's called I Was in a Hurry. Yesterday I lost a country. I was in a hurry and didn't notice when it fell from me, like a broken branch from a forgetful tree. Please, if anyone passes by and stumbles across it, perhaps in a suitcase open to the sky, or engraved on a rock like a gaping wound, or wrapped in the blankets of emigrants, or canceled like a losing lottery ticket, or helplessly forgotten in purgatory, or rushing forward without a goal like the questions of children, or rising with the smoke of war, or rolling in a helmet on the sand, or stolen in Alibaba's jar, or disguised in the uniform of a policeman who stirred up the prisoners and fled, or squatting in the mind of a woman who tries to smile, or scattered like the dreams of new immigrants in America. If anyone stumbles across it, return it to me, please. Please return it, sir. Please return it, madam. It is my country.
good afternoon and welcome.
Writing for a purpose. Just a quick background of myself. I'm an 18-year-old college freshman that enjoys writing and creating indie films.
Sort of artistically ambidextrous. He's not only... And this year's honor also goes to Elena Schnell. Congratulations to you all. And if the rest of the winners could be seated, except for Hassan, if you could be seated until you know you're called up to the stage to read your work. Hassan. Hassan Al-Maliki is sort of artistically ambidextrous. He's not only a writer, but he's a filmmaker. In fact, he and a team of creatives won 4 Emmys for their work on a short film at the Natas. Was that the U of M?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool, okay. Hassan loves to make movies with his friends and his twin brother. When I asked him what inspired the story called Sender that he submitted to our competition, he said he was driving around with his dad and saw the sign in an industrial workspace, and it read "Authorized personnel only." And I thought that's a story. I love that because writers, that's what we do. We try to do. We take the world as it is and reveal its depths in ways that allow others to better see the profundity of everyday life. Hassan explained that he loves Stephen King, especially stories like The Mist. And I can see that influence in the story he submitted, which recounts, and I won't do too much in case he's reading that. I don't want to spoil it, but I wanted to read a little bit. Fear is full of him. The figure approaches him slowly. Run back inside. No, the shed is closer. Chris starts towards the shed and locks himself inside. There are beers. Boxes stacked upon each other. That doesn't matter. What matters is that unhuman-looking thing that looks like it wants to kill him. I love that line, fear is full of him, not the other way around, because it certainly doesn't feel like Hassan is full of fear. He seems ready to tackle any opportunity brought his way. Please help me congratulate and welcome Hassan Al-Maliki.
Hello, everyone. I just want to say I feel honored to be able to read my story in front of you today. I'm very much thankful for being amongst the top winners, and I definitely wasn't expecting for this to happen. But at the end of the day, I did what I loved, and that was creatively free writing. And also want to thank the English faculty for putting together this cool opportunity for writers like myself to get a chance on Writing for a Purpose. Just a quick background. Myself, I'm an 18-year-old college freshman that enjoys writing and creating indie films. I find inspiration in a lot of normal, everyday things, which is what basically inspired me to write my story in the first place. I came across an abandoned-looking factory building one day and thought to myself that there has to be more, and maybe if I wrote a story behind it, I could kind of make up a story that unveils what really happens behind those walls. It goes like this. it was a cold November night. Thousands of stars swallow the dark, cloudless sky. Watching over an industrial building, sitting in a lone, dense forest, a factory of some sort, a place seen off limits to the residents living nearby. Inside, a deep corridor lined by humming fluorescence lights attract our attention to a heavy metal door at the end. A sign posted in front of it clearly tries to deter anyone who comes across it. It reads, "Authorized personnel only." It seems to be built to keep something inside. The intense humming of the fluorescence sting the ear stronger and stronger until wham. The door explodes open, the hinges shrieking. A man in a construction vest and helmet staggers out terrified. Sweat races down his trembled face as he runs towards the end of the hall, towards an elevator. As he arrives, he spams the elevator's buttons to get the doors to open, keeping an eye behind his shoulders. Someone or something is after him. Finally, the elevator's ding sounds. Thank God. The doors of the elevator slide open. The man squeezes himself at the first possible second. He spams the elevator's buttons again. He has a chance. There's not much he could do but wait for the elevator to respond. All he could do is watch the end of the hall. Is it still after him? The doors finally close. Is he safe? Why is the elevator moving? Something was wrong. Thud. The lights in the elevator shut off abruptly. Only the faint emergency lights glow on the man's petrified face. Then, a low, rumble, gargling noise sinks the man's stomach. A tall, ugly shadow grows behind him. Outside the elevator, the man bangs and bangs on, now wanting to escape the elevator. The banging slows down until silence. We move away from the elevator that was once a place of safety but has now become a cage of death. Elsewhere, it's still the same cold night. We find ourselves in suburbia. Small one-story houses line an empty street. You can now see that awkward industrial building from here. It's too close to home. We find a house with a pit bull dog chained to a pole outside. It wants something. Inside, we find our heroes playing pool, which with a couple of beers, having a good time. Pass me another, Cade demands a friend. A couple more of those and you'll find yourself knocked down, out under a tree cold. David responds to him as he hands him a cold beer from a retro fridge. You want to be a part of the conversation? Cade asks as he pops open a bottle of beer. He turns over to another friend who sits alone in the couch watching them play pool. He obviously doesn't want to be there. I'm good here, Chris simply responds. Chris, you said you wanted to have fun tonight, didn't you? David asks as he gets into striking position. Ugh, why do I even hang out with them? Chris asks himself. Where do you keep the beers, David? Chris asks in a desperate way to escape that room. We got a fresh box out in the shed. Let me get it for you. David responds. No, no. I don't want to ruin your game, Chris asks as he gets up to head out through the back door. The door takes him into a summer room, but it seems to be more of a storage room because, to be honest, there's not much purpose if it's cold out. Jesus, where's the light switch? Chris thinks to himself, his hands tapping the walls looking for a light switch. They land on one. Flick. Nothing. Of course they don't work. Why would they? Just goes to show how inconsiderate David is when it comes to house care. There probably isn't even a bulb to turn on. Chris tries to make his way around the maze of stacked boxes in the dark until he eventually finds the main back door that takes him to the house's garden. As he steps out, the smell of skunk enters his breath. Or is that marijuana? Wouldn't it be his first call? His eyes land on the shed that sits across from the yard. It's made out of some oak wood that looks like it's ready about to give up on itself, holding itself together. But it's a better idea to keep the beers cold outside than trying to stuff as much as you can in the small fridge, I guess. Chris's eyes land on the dog. It's David's pit bull. God, it's freezing out here, he says to himself. Chris makes his way to the dog to pet him. Why is he leaving you out here? He asks the dog. He notices that the dog's bowl is flipped over, just about out of reach for the dog. Chris picks up the bowl and brings it closer to the dog. Yeah, that food isn't enough. Don't worry. I'll get you some more, he assures the dog as he continues to stroke his head. As Chris gets up to walk over to the shed, he stops dead in his tracks. What is it? The ugly orange of the street lights in front of him frames a silhouette of a strange figure watching him from the distance. It is dark, murky, and still. A strange guttural sound comes from the figure. It sounds like the one from the elevator. Its proportions seem off. Fear is full of him. The figure approaches him slowly. Run back inside. No, the shed is closer. Chris darts towards the shed and locks himself inside. Well, that was a good idea. It's dark in there. A string brushes up against his face that dangles from the ceiling. Thank God, a light bulb. Chris flicks it open to see what's inside. There are the beers, boxes stacked upon each other. That doesn't matter. What matters is that unhuman-looking thing that looks like it wants to kill him. Chris scrambles to the shed's window. He cups his hands to the glass door, to the glass, and peers back out into the garden. Maybe he's just seeing things. A gust of wind blows on week-old laundry fluttering on clotheslines. I can't see. The clothes obstruct his view. Another gust of wind blows on the clothes, this time stronger. Now it gives him a clear view of the yard. It's that figure again. It just stands there. He's not seeing things. It's very real. It could just be a person wandering about. No, he is now lying to himself. Chris looks over to his left, a hunting rifle. I've never shot before, Chris thinks to himself. He probably doesn't even know how to work one. Chris yanks it out of the wall rack and retrieves a few ammo shells from a nearby workbench. He begins to load the weapon as fast as he can, but his trembling hands won't stay still enough to allow him to fill the slots. Chris keeps an eye on the shed's door. Any second, it will walk in. The outside creates a ghostly howl noise, the shed's unstable walls creaking. Finally, Chris loads the dusty rifle and points it towards the door. The rifle trembles in his hands. He's ready for what's to come. Why isn't David's dog barking anymore? The naked dangling light bulb above him begins to hum a lot like the fluorescence in the factory. Chris notices but keeps his eyes trained at the door. This sounds familiar. A shadowy figure slowly rises from behind him. Chris feels something breathing down his neck. He slowly turns, lowering his rifle. It's not going to help. Just then, a high-pitched shrieking sound fills the shed. Chris just stares, paralyzed by fear. The bulb above him begins to hum louder and louder, the lights growing stronger and stronger. We think the glass of the bulb will shatter, but then the terrible shrieking abruptly stops. The light returns to normal. Now the shed is empty. The end.
Good afternoon. When I last introduced Kalima Gardner to a Barrett audience in 2022, I reported that as a kid, she twice won Kroger's I Can Make History poetry contest. This year, I'm pleased to report that she's now won the Barrett contest three times. This is her third year in a row. In 2022, I noted her poems typically focus on people's inner experiences, and in this year's winning entries, she explores her own private experiences of love and vulnerability. Her poem called Perfect Strangers was inspired by Billie Holiday's Good Morning Heartache, in which the singer personifies her suffering as what we nowadays might call a frenemy. In Kalima's poem, misery is personified as a faithful lover whose familiarity and fidelity eventually gained not just the speaker's acceptance, but even her affection. It's part of her experience that she, quote, can't help but tragically love, and she makes room for it in her life. While Perfect Strangers depicts the gradual acceptance of the seemingly inevitable, her second poem, called The Real Dance, does the opposite, when a fleeting encounter triggers a desire for a relationship that will never be. Walt Whitman expresses something similar in a poem that confesses, "O you whom I often and silently come where you are, that I may be with you. Little do you know the subtle electric fire that for your sake is playing within me." Perhaps you can relate. The isolation that Kalima's speaker feels leads her to think about the distance we keep from each other in daily life, especially since COVID. And then that thought is countered by an earlier memory of the comfortable intimacy of a high school date when she was, quote, not afraid to make two hearts touch. The poem traces a psychologically realistic chain of associations as the speaker moves from a pensive moment through a pang of loneliness to a place of emotional comfort. Next year, the Barrett Awards will have to somehow carry on without Kalima Gardner because she will be at the prestigious film school at Chapman University in Southern California studying film production with the goal of becoming a creative producer. But this year, we are honored to have her read from her work one last time. Kalima.
I'm so short. Hi everyone, please bear with me. I just got off my statistics class, so my brain's kind of but I will try my best. I will start with the poem, The Real Dance, and then I will go on to Perfect Strangers. So this is The Real Dance. A stranger's eyes dance with mine, and as I'm handing him his cash, a stranger's eyes dance with mine as I'm handing him his cash. But he and his ripped back pocket leave before we can exchange numbers, before ever getting to say hello. And like the arrival of time, he comes as quickly as he goes. My worry eyes follow him as he exits through the automatic doors, disappearing forever, leaving me behind with a curious heart. And that's how life is now. My eyes dance with the worthy component, but never touching. People making sure to stay 6 feet apart from love, 6 feet away from exchanging warm goodbyes and hellos, afraid to get close to one another. But as I glance back at my prom photo, I remember how it felt to be touched. My date's warm hands lightly grasped my shoulders, and I could feel the buoyant butterflies arise in the pit of my core. The exchange of soft glances, the sweetness of his voice ringing softly in my ears, my nose bathing in the sweet smell of his cologne, feeling the humming of his heartbeat against mine, not afraid to make two hearts touch. And then this is Perfect Strangers. Misery, a disease, a reminder, a song constantly playing. I push repeat as I see its melodies running frantically across my mind, moving furniture within my groins, a permanent stranger running his crooked feet across my welcome mat. I hear a knock, and like a child screaming for hands to hold, I fetch the door. It smiles the same grin, my cheeks begin to burn. We seem to greet each other easily. And as the sun continues to chase the moon and the sky blushes the perfect blue, I am drawn to it, a broken record I can't help but play. My fingers, I fiend to its rhythm. Is it something that can be slain? Use my mighty sword as if killing a monster I envisioned as a child? Or will it be resilient? And we'd be forever intertwined by our parasitic friendship. At least I'd never be lonely. Misery, grasping my fallen heart with its loyal hands as I kissed its faithful lips. Misery, a song, the perfect stranger I can't help but tragically love. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Maggie Rutkowski, and I am delighted to be able to introduce you to our fourth place winner of this year's competition and his poem, The Fallen Orchard. Meeting the author, Omar, only made me appreciate this work even more, as the personal and political are interwoven to create the very image in our minds that inspired this thoughtful and mournful creation. Omar, a computer science major, told me earlier this week that he doesn't like to boast, but he does have a creative mind. While that is certainly evident in the poem you are about to hear, he also programs random calculators, coin flipping machines, and weather forecasts for fun. His creative writing instructor from fall 2023, Ms. Ruth Ann Schmidt, also recognized his creative spark, and as Omar puts it, kept nudging him on. When Omar bumped into Ms. Schmidt in the hallway this semester, she asked him if he had submitted for Barrett. So thank you, Ms. Schmidt, for encouraging this hesitant author to share his talent with us. The Fallen Orchard arose out of an assignment from that creative writing class, where students were asked to write either a personal poem or a political poem based on a specific image. Omar chose a photograph of his dear uncle holding figs and grapes in his hands, products of the family farm in Gaza. The photograph was taken in August 2023, 3 months before the war began. Now, all that remains of this treasured land lies in the memories of Omar and all those who felt what he felt, looking out at the orchards, the vegetables, the animals. What stands out to the reader, or listener, in The Fallen Orchard is the way that this piece is both deeply rooted in the past and burned into our present consciousness, timeless yet urgent. Omar says he immediately thought of this photo as the one to use for that assignment, and that the poem came to him rather quickly. It reads that way, as a flowing stream with only natural stanza breaks and an efficient yet impactful choice of words. The last part of the poem is its author's favorite, and I tend to agree. For as he told me, memories stay, no matter what. Please join me as we walk with Omar through his lens of memories. Here is the amazingly creative author himself to share The Fallen Orchard.
Hello. Thank you, guys. My name is Omar, and this is my poem, The Fallen Orchard. In the lens of memories in diaspora Palestine, a photograph reveals an uncle with figs and grapes in his gentle hands, amidst an orchard, 53 years old, blooming with love, watered by tears of family labor and orchard cultivation, under the sun's warm glow. It was a haven, a cherished land. But beyond the lens and life's twisted fate, by the force of a bomb, in a land oppressed by those who believe it's their right, the orchard is blown, leaving behind nothing but sorrow and despair, scattering memories into the wind. Gone are the figs, the olives, the aged trees. Gone is a home reduced to rubble and dust, leaving echoes of the past. And as people witness a history brought to its knees, gone are the voices too. The orchard may be gone, but its roots still run through. So let the photograph speak, let her portray the family's daily endurance in the face of oppression and pain. For in this picture, the orchard lives on in the beautiful tales yet to come. Thank you.
I guess I should introduce myself, sorry. My name is Jessica. I'm an instructor in the ELI here. I have the pleasure of introducing Lexi Drysdale, our third place winner, for her piece called 40 More Ounces, A White Trash Romance. This was one of my absolute favorite pieces this year, so I'm so thrilled to be able to introduce Lexi, who will be reading in a moment. So this submission actually started out as a class assignment, which as a writing teacher would be like my dream, but I can only just fantasize about what it would be like because it hasn't happened yet. But it would be so cool, like give an assignment and then watch that piece kind of grow and evolve into something really great like this. So maybe one day. So the assignment that Lexi had was to write about a relationship. So after having gone through a 10-year relationship with alcohol and noticing a bottle of Jameson on the table that was left by her roommate, she decided to write about that toxic relationship with alcohol. And it reminded me of a song by Miranda Lambert called White Trash, in which we oftentimes have this need to portray this perfect exterior and try to hide the trashy things about our lives or personalities. But then like Lexi kind of takes it to a point where it's ultimately okay and makes the conscious decision to just not try to hide it at all, which is really beautiful. And there's so much honesty in how she writes it, which is why I felt so connected to it. Even if you don't have personal experience going through that kind of issue, it's very relatable. For me personally, because I actually have witnessed those types of relationships, it's something that I believe can be just as, if not more so, psychologically and emotionally complex than just a relationship between two people. And there is a part in Lexi's piece that she actually admits that oftentimes it was very difficult to discern who was the abuser and who was the abused in that relationship, which I think speaks to how muddled it can be. And plus it's super duper hard to like air out your dirty laundry, right, for public judgment. And I think that takes a level of vulnerability and courage, which I told Lexi that she was so brave to be willing to do that, especially with an issue like alcoholism that is oftentimes kind of like pushed under the rug, or at least like we're very quick to jump to judgments and criticizing and labeling. But this piece just kind of humanizes our trash, right? And I think that was really amazing. So everybody has like trash in their life or a mess that they would rather not show the world, that's unpretty or they don't want to expose. And so I think that this piece really deserves accolades for Lexi being so brave and have the courage to view that mess. And so I thanked her already, but I'm going to thank her again for just being willing and proud to share her beautifully written mess with us today. Welcome.
Thank you. All right, I'm just going to read a little excerpt of this. It was somewhere between my 10th and 12th year when the flame was kindled, a few years after I was first introduced to her most precious blood by the bishop at my first communion. My mom had fallen asleep early, as she did at the time, because mental illness, especially in working-class women, is treated as a nuisance to be pacified rather than a legitimate medical condition in the almighty for-profit medical system. In other words, she was prescribed enough Klonopin to make even Anna Nicole Smith blush. I made my siblings go to bed early and put on the ESPN awards. I believe former Red Wing Pavel Datsyuk was nominated for something that year, and I went to go grab a pop from the fridge. As I walked to the kitchen, I noticed a barely drunk bottle of whipped cream-flavored vodka in my mom's antique oak liquor cabinet. Before I knew it, I was pouring what was probably the equivalent of 7 shots worth of the sickly sweet flavor-infused vodka into my large WrestleMania Slurpee cup from 7-Eleven, filling the rest of the cup with instant iced tea. It was love at first sight. When I say it was love, it must be emphasized that I have been a pervert as long as I can remember. My 12 to 15 year romance with the poison was more like Pink Flamingos than Breakfast at Tiffany's, more like the image than Casablanca. It was intense, cheap, perverse, sensual, and lacked anything resembling subtlety. It was as queer of a romance as a sad, perverted closet case could find at the time, and it might not have been the popular definition of romance, but it was love nonetheless. Our first couple years were puppy love. We had only held hands and shared the occasional closed-mouth kiss. It was a sip of beer here, a little bit of liquor there, the blood of Christ at Mass, and the occasional child-sized portion of Chianti or sip of Sambuca at Sunday dinner. It was sweet, sloppy, but still sweet. It was not until I was 13 years old that we fully consummated our relationship. I'm usually the dominant and top in romantic endeavors, but in this sordid relationship, it was different. When I say that she fucked me, I mean she really fucked me. She kept me up to the wee hours of the morning, tying me up and pounding me into submission in every position possible. I was deflowered. Most people ease their way into that kinky stuff, but I was lucky enough to experience this raw burst of emotive romance on my first try. Sure, it hurt, bad in fact, but there's always been a thin line between pleasure and pain that I will forever walk. That night, her skin tasted like cheap tequila, Pall Mall Light, Seagram's Gin, and store brand cola, and her breath smelt of lime. I never thought that I would lose my virginity in my grandparents' basement, but they were not home and she was too beautiful and had a firm enough grip around my neck for me not to focus around that. A less responsible kid would have thrown a party, but I was more than happy to spend the night in her everlasting arms. I knew from this night on we were finally serious. I wanted to be beat up, humiliated, fucked, caressed, and cared for by her every night. That ethereal moment of drunken splendor kept me blindly devoted for her for the next 10 to 12 years, and for the better part of that time, she did not let me down. High school was not an easy time for me. That's not to say it was not fun and I did not do well, but it was indeed filled with the quiet self-hatred, forbidden bisexual yearning, imposter syndrome, pubescent rage and gender confusion every poor mentally ill closet case tranny from a poor mentally ill family goes through. In fact, pretending to be a good Catholic boy was the only thing anywhere near as difficult as divorcing my first love. Though all the teenage turmoil, she was there through me. Long days at school were remedied with a Newport, a spliff, and an evening clad in 40 ounces of glassy emerald lingerie. If my old man's opiate habit was affecting the family more than usual, it should be noted that he is now happily separated from that mistress. Her malted barley body would seduce me with her sultry Irish brogue. If I needed help socializing, her agave eyes have never failed me. Just thinking about the way her lips tasted would linger on mine brings me back to the times when I was still her baby. Around this time, she started to share her more sophisticated side with me. Though I still yearned through those evenings disrobing her Bordeaux, single malt añejo, and cognac, I always preferred her Mickey's t-shirt and Jameson hat. She had begun becoming more comfortable showing herself off around my friends at this time. Some people might be possessive and call her a slut for this type of behavior, but I was happy to share her because I knew she'd still be coming home to me. I still think about those sweaty punk shows I spent hooking up with her or being cuckolded while my friends took her rather than watching the bands. I also cannot forget the many basement parties and kickbacks where we left early to take long walks together until I was sick from exhaustion or the sun came up. We could not keep our hands off each other. She showed me her sweet side in these years as well. She was the only one who could be completely honest with me at times. She would listen without judgment when I told her about the struggles of school life, home life, gender dysphoria, self-doubt, trouble, and pain. She never doubted me or talked over me, and always made me feel important. She never called me a faggot when I told her about the crushes I had on my male friends, or I felt more powerful with eyeliner on. She always made me and my problems the first priority. More than anything, she was completely selfless. She always comforted me in her warm caress when I was feeling down, and all she asked for in return was my obedience, submission, and devotion. It was true love. It was around this time I brought around my first real girlfriend, and she started to show her jealous side. I tried to keep my relationship from each of them separate. Since pretending to be a boy, I figured there was nothing more quintessentially male than having an affair. My first love, however, could not stand the idea of other women, and she punished me. She made it very clear the only way both lovers could coexist would be if she had a seat at the table in my new relationship. I tried to compromise and let her join in on a date night and nights out, but she would not have it. It seemed like the closer my real girlfriend and I got, the more she would punish me. My body was always sore and bruised up after those nights shared between all three of us. The physical and mental anguish was sometimes unbearable. I cannot count how many nights she beat the shit out of me for spending time away from her. The things she would do to me would leave me shaking in fear if I didn't obey her for a few days. If it wasn't physical pain, the bitch would use sleep deprivation to get her ways. I asked for it though, right? Isn't this how BDSM relationships are supposed to work? Isn't this the kind of love queers are deserving of? All the while I was trying to navigate the first relationship I had besides her was unbearable. Most times I'd cave and just talk one of them into a threesome. I wasn't happy, my girlfriend wasn't happy, and the booze wasn't happy. It was hardly a compromise. My two lovers could not stand one another, but I selfishly ignored this and let the booze have her way. It was better than the headaches and lack of sleep, and if I was discreet, the poison and I could have a quickie in the bathroom while my girlfriend was in the other room. Out of sight, out of mind. Still, the fact that she coerced her way into my first more traditional romance should have been unforgivable, but she still understood me better than anyone and always came running back. When my high school sweetheart and I parted ways, alcohol stayed with me and supported me.
When I started dating my other long-term ex, my first love was even more open-minded and allowed us to be a throuple for a while. The booze introduced herself to my friend Amphetamine around this time. The four of us spent many nights together, and my ex didn't even know Speed was in on the action. This brief but intense polyamorous romance with Speed was the only thing my new flame did for me. Thank you, everyone.
Good afternoon, the man behind the curtain. Peter Kim, I teach English and journalism here. I'm proud to introduce our second place winner. When Alana DiMaggio introduced herself to me wanting to write for the college's student newspaper, the Mirror News, I could tell she had a writer's sensibility. Perhaps from having lived 2 years in Kuwait, Alana has a perceptiveness that comes from seeing the world beyond its borders. Perhaps having read Joan Didion, whom she lists among her favorite authors, Alana's ability to bring into focus seemingly minor details, imbuing them with depth and emotion, is expressed in lines like, "I drop my fork on my plate so hard it chips." Also like Didion, Alana seamlessly mixes verse with narrative, inserting thoughtful asides like, am I talking about his relationship or am I talking about ours? But make no mistake, Alana's writing is her own and reveals a complex and heartfelt relationship with her father that can only come from a daughter with a big enough heart to accommodate contradictions. I am so pleased to introduce such a delightful and aspiring writer who I know will continue to win awards and be recognized for her talents. Please welcome Alana DiMaggio as she reads from her second place winning entry in this year's Barrett Creative Writing Contest titled, My Father's Love.
Hi, these are excerpts from my piece, My Father's Love. Did you know that scars can still hurt long after the flesh and skin have been mended? It has something to do with nerve endings getting trapped in the scar tissue. This is to say, some wounds never fully heal. The Greek word for wound is trauma. I once read a book about the way trauma reshapes your brain. This is to say, there are some things you can never get over. Have you ever eaten dinner at a restaurant alone before? He asked me. His blue eyes are oceans of sadness. No, I reply. It doesn't feel good. I poke at my pasta, trying to imagine my father sitting alone, sipping from his lemonade and eating his baked ziti. He wants my pity, but I don't have any to give him. There's a sharp pain in my side as the bitterness I'm harboring begins to leak into my bloodstream. I wouldn't mind, I lie. I like to be alone with my thoughts. He doesn't know how to respond, so our conversation falls silent. How do you feel about all this? He questions. By all this, he means divorcing my mom. This dinner is supposed to fix things between us. I don't know if bottomless breadsticks and crappy Italian food could fix anything. I scoff, the bitterness seeping into my mouth. I hate how we never talk about how weird this all is. I mean, you and Mom aren't even together anymore, and we're all still living in the same house. It's not weird, he cuts me off, adding fuel to the fight that's just sparked. Yes, it is weird. I know everyone thinks so. I'm just the only person to bring it up. It makes me feel like a bitch, I snap back. I've decided that I'm the kind of daughter who swears at her parents now. It's one of the little rebellions that makes me feel like I have some control over my life. Well, yeah, sometimes you can be a bitch, he says matter-of-factly, like it's one of my defining characteristics. A few months ago, he was on the phone with my grandparents. I was perched at the top of the stairs, eavesdropping. He told them about how my mom made him put all his belongings in trash bags when he left and how humiliating it was. She's just being such a bitch about the whole thing, he spat, dripping in disdain and a wounded ego. She's smart, funny, and a raging bitch, just like her mother, I can imagine him saying, and I hold my breath to prevent myself from making a scene in this Olive Garden. I drop my fork on my plate so hard it chips. I think I'm ready to go now. My father has never apologized to me. Maybe he doesn't know how. I don't think anyone has ever taught him. On nights when I can't sleep, I imagine my father as a little boy with big front teeth and even bigger glasses. I hold his little hand in mine and tell him I'm sorry. For what? He asks me. I just am. He doesn't say anything, but I think he understands. I'm sorry for everything that's happened, for everything that will, and for the things that won't. I'm sorry that life doesn't always go as planned, that some things never go back to the way they were. And I forgive you. He squeezes my hand and wipes his sleeve on his nose on the sleeve of his sweater. I know he's sorry too. My father loves me because he tells me so. My father loves me when he kisses me on the cheek and says he's missed me. I know my father loves me because we don't bring up the things that make us upset. Instead, we talk about the weather, the Lions game, and the time I threw up in the airport and everybody saw. When he looks at me, he sees himself. My father loves me because I love him. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Ruth Ann Schmidt, and I teach creative writing among other writing classes here at HFC. It is a great honor to introduce this year's first place winner for the Barrett and Creative Writing Creative Coulter Prize winner, Elena Schnell, an inspiring journalist and creative writer, who plays for two poems, Polka Dotted Spring Poem and Villanelle. When I asked her about her inspirations for each poem, she mentioned such greats as Sandra Cisneros for her simplicity, Nabokov for his linguistic beauty, and T.S. Eliot for his pomposity. These inspirations are not surprising, as they are mixed into the two delightful and self-referential poems you are about to hear. The polka-dotted spring poem is a poet's beautifully crafted, self-conscious dialogue about whether the poem itself is a spring or summer poem. But according to Elena, the poem marks the moment when it's too early to wear the bathing suit that you bought at the spring sale. But on a bright spring day, you put it on anyway. The second poem, Villanelle, is a villanelle, making light of poetic pomposity with linguistic hyperbolic flourishes that speak of self-importance. It is a feathery pink puffball that says, look at me. Both poems are charming. And now I give you a link.
Hi, I'm Elena. I'm really honored to be here. It's definitely a privilege, so thank you. I'm going to be reading my first poem is Villanelle, so I'll be reading that first. A brilliant nimbus twirled towards heaven. Her feathers coruscating, she looks like airy vanilla ice cream. Obsession made me confuse a 6-4-7 and lazy my wide American lips, like those Slavic poets soured by lust. Ending stanzas with gray muddied expression, my vowels, illumining soft light, lay squeezes fat letters dry like lemons. A brilliant nimbus twirls towards heaven. Her smile is suffocating me like July's heavy breath. My favorite lesson I fail to learn from. Take me to heaven. Let me comb down your pink fluff. It looks like the outstretched fur of cotton candy. In a trance, I watch you soar into heaven without me. You weep crystals, such a sight to see. Your tears shatter to earth without an end. Why didn't you fly me to the heavens? And then my second one is the polka dot spring poem. How could one write about spring without flirting with beehives and sunburnt boys who make out with beer cans and raven-eyed girls? Spring poems don't exist if you can't rhyme sun with sultry swimsuits that we bought on sale when December's pessimism was present in our Christmas letters and batter mixed with too much egg and not enough eye contact. You know, the polka dot suit sliced into two Yes, those ones. The ones we slid into after school in mid-May. The sun hissed and slapped our bare bellies, leaving a loud red mark your sister laughed at, saying you're too nice to dress like a girl who gives mean hickeys. You ought to wear your smart church dress to the beach so the boys playing volleyball know not to invite you to their court or introduce you to their couch. You know, the salmon-colored beat-to-shit kind. But of course you wore the swimsuit, because grains of sand hugging your thighs as you splash with as you giggle with splashing tides on a school night with a boy that you'll never see again was a spring poem, but it felt like summer. You had to write about. You wove his bruised wrist into the opening line because you forgot his name and the number of white zits you counted on his chin and how his marbled eyes made up for those zits. You sprinkled each couplet with salt water and your exclamation marks flipped upside down into an I. Rose petals hanging their legs off its dot. The semicolons hope your ode to the silk magnolia petals that swam through its waved hair never stop. But I don't think he spoke about you in the way that you wrote about him. He didn't tell them about the strawberry freckles that walk across the bridge of your nose, or your fizzle laughter that the seagulls carried home to the young. He told them about your polka dot swimsuit and how it looked better in the sand than on you. He talked in black letters, and without a clue, he experienced a spring poem. Although it felt like summer on that mid-May day, it was still spring because you both rose for school the next day. That's it.
How about another round of applause for all of our readers today? Thank you all for coming. Come back next year. It's gonna be, half of a century. And if you get a minute, say congratulations, chat with the readers. Thank you all for joining us.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager, Learning the Lingo.
Today I'm going to help parents translate teen slang. Now, when a teen says something is on fleek, it's exactly like saying, that's rad. It simply means that something is awesome or cool. Another one is totes. It's exactly like saying, totally, just shorter. As in, I totes love going to the mall with Becca. Another word you might hear is jelly. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous, as in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will think you're, rad just the same. To learn more, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
You seen him, you dug him. Now here he is with the beat that's sweet and the jive that's alive.
Chasing rabbits.
Chase, the wife rabbit's hot wax radio to his new time on Sunday nights, 7 to 9 p.m. Woohoo! Yeah!
From the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, featuring local and independent artists. Coming up in just a matter of moments, Kitty Love and Highway 61. That's next.
It is another Friday night at WHFR, and Friday nights is when my weekend begins. So please join me, your weekend girl, Missy J, from 8 p.m. until 12 a.m. It's still the house that Jack Swing built. We are WHFR Dearborn, 89.3 FM on your dial.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
South of Memphis, Tennessee.